Hello, this is Dean Kernut, and welcome to the Alpha Exchange, where we explore topics in financial markets associated with managing risk, generating return, and the deployment of capital in the alternative investment industry.
After a six-week hiatus during which I was recovering from a serious jet ski accident, I'm excited to bring you a fresh episode of the Alpha Exchange. And it was wonderful to spend time with Andrew Scott, a partner and head of investor solutions at Bock Option. Our conversation is an exploration into the complex factors that drive the clearing price for volatility in equity markets. In this context, we spend no time on the economic cycle or corporate profits or the latest missive from the Fed. Instead, Andrew explains how the vast industry of Asian structured products leaves banks with complex exposures to optionality, correlation, and dividends. These trades, designed to create income in countries like South Korea that have seen interest rates in secular decline, leave banks with substantial long vol positions. Through our conversation, we learn of the concept of peak vega, an industry estimate for the level of the underlying index where banks are most long volatility. Andrew also lays out in great detail the risk recycling that has long operated alongside the structured products universe. Here, depressed levels of index vol and skew in Asia encouraged hedge funds and asset managers to implement volatility relative value trades versus the S&P. Lastly, we touch on Andrew's new position at Bock Option, joining founder Mao Dan Wu in building out a firm dedicated to understanding and trading volatility at a time of great change in markets and plenty of catalysts for the next big event. I hope you enjoy my discussion with Andrew Scott. My guest today on the Alpha Exchange is Andrew Scott. He is a partner and head of client solutions at Bock Option. Andrew, it's great to have you on the podcast today.
Hi, Dean. It's an absolute pleasure to be on the show. I'm a big fan and avid listener, but I've got to be honest, I'm a bit concerned that your standards are slipping if you're asking people like me to be a guest.
I doubt it very much. I came across your work at the EQD conference in 2018, which I enjoyed, but for about a 12-hour delay at McCarran Airport on the way back. That was pure theta as it comes to options. But we're going to have a great conversation. It's really good to connect with you, and it's great to see you working with an old friend of mine, Dr. Wu. So we'll get into the work that Bock is doing and a lot to talk about just in terms of the complex products that often dominate some of the Asian derivatives markets, and you're an expert on that. Get us started with how you found your way into high finance. How did you get your start on Wall Street?
I think it really wasn't until my third birthday when I really knew I wanted to be an investment banker. Fast forward 14 years, following in the footsteps of George Soros and more importantly, Mick Jagger, I attended the London School of Economics. For those of you who didn't attend the LSE, it's entirely irrelevant what career aspirations you had. On entry, you will depart that place desperately attempting to become a banker. It's truly remarkable. But I didn't need much convincing. My brother-in-law was an M&A banker for Goldman's, then Lazard's on Wall Street in the 90s, and it all sounded terribly exciting. Then at 19 years of age, three life-changing things happened to me in very quick succession. I met my amazing wife. I suffered a career-ending injury playing semi-professional football or soccer. And for some unbeknown reason, Deutsche Bank offered me my first job on a trading floor in London, which proved to be a wonderful learning ground. So I started out in trading. Like many, I assumed I'd quickly transition into portfolio management. However, somehow that morphed into a 16-year career with five more investment banks and stints in Hong Kong, Tokyo, and New York after London. I mean, there's clearly something wonderful about working for one firm for 20 years, but I took great joy out of constantly reinventing myself and proving myself at new firms and in new environments. I essentially spent my career on a mission to try and understand the perspectives and the thought processes of all the different actors across products, asset classes, and client base, because that would best inform my own view. And that would put me in a privileged position because it didn't matter if I was advising a hedge fund in Sao Paulo or a super in Sydney. You know, I always felt confident I could add some level of unique value to every client I engaged. The one core consistency across my career, however, was equity derivatives. And obviously, that's what we're going to focus on today. It was drilled into me very early on that whatever investment outcome you're trying to achieve, it could always be done more efficiently with derivatives. And I very much believe that's true. Now, without overly sounding like Liam Neeson in the movie Taken, you know, I definitely won't do the Irish accent either, but I developed a very particular set of skills. I was able to quantify and describe in an extensive detail the nature and balance of structural drivers in vol markets, And my work in that space allowed me to represent my firm on TV, more broadly in the press, and at many conferences around the world, which is obviously where you and I have crossed paths. So it took me 2 decades to figure it out, but I think I've now fully appreciated my own value proposition, which is one, translating the language of derivatives into English and framing it in some sort of relevant context, and two, performing portfolio threat analysis, and hopefully I have a role now that should maximize the value of that. You know, I've had the distinct pleasure of working with some truly outstanding individuals on the sell side, but I finally agreed to move across to the buy side at the end of last year, joined, as you already mentioned, the legendary Dr. Miaodan Wu at Bark Option, who you obviously know very well, and I couldn't be happier.
So you'll get a quick flavor for what it feels like to be on the buy side and covered by the legions and legions of sell-siders putting ideas in front of you 24/7.
I do have a lot of unread messages in my inbox.
Right, exactly. You talked about just being someone that has focused on explaining derivatives and really bringing them to life and playing a role in articulating the drivers of pricing and relationships. And I think just as we get this conversation underway, just making the distinction between the very, very plain vanilla U.S. listed option, as liquid as could be, but as plain vanilla in a lot of ways relative to its sister markets in Asia and Europe. The most common option traded around here is the one-day Tesla option. Doesn't have much to it. Got a lot of gamma, a lot of theta, but that's really where the complexity ends. And of course, in Europe, and I would say especially Asia, this appetite for complexity has really been a cornerstone of the markets. And so this is where I was hoping we could spend some time, because these markets are so unique and you've got so many insights on these complex products. Take us through, to start this at a 30,000 foot level, if you were to describe to the U.S. listed options person what it is that the derivatives markets in Asia are solving for broadly, what are the risk characteristics? See if you can start with just the big picture of what these markets look like, the non-listed aspects of the Asian derivatives markets.
First of all, maybe if I take one step back, Dean, let me ask you a question. What do Greek people call Greek salad? And I promise it's not a trick question.
Salad.
Exactly, because you're a very intelligent Andy, but it's very simple. So, you know, I love asking junior exotic traders this question after debating third order derivatives with them, because while some of the mathematics associated with managing the Greek risks of these retail structure products are indeed complex, and we'll get into that later on, it's actually much simpler than you think. It's just as important to remember that simple concepts like sentiment and yield are actually even more critical to your overall understanding. So I'm going to give you a big picture overview of what Asia looks like and this preponderance of retail structured products, but I'll try and also demonstrate the logic and rationale. Look, in their most basic form, these are simply bond-like structures that are attempting to pay a sufficiently compelling yield over and above the risk-free government bonds. This is what a retail structured product is. So the decision to purchase a retail structured product in Asia is a pure bond substitution argument, nothing more, nothing less. So unsurprisingly, where did they originate? In Japan, of course, the one region of the world that's lived with zero rates for longer than anyone else. So retail structured products are not new in the world, and in Asia in particular, they've been around for a very long time, but it's the breadth and scale of usage which has exploded in recent years with no obvious structural offset anymore. And again, we'll speak about that later on. But if we take the example of South Korea and look at what happened to their interest rates, in the late 1990s, deposit rates were double digits. In the past year, they've traded sub 1%. It is precisely this loss of risk-free yield which drove $500 trillion. Let me repeat that, $500 trillion notional of autocallable note issuance, equivalent to around $2.5 billion of Vega supply over the last decade. So that is being supplied across global equity vol markets. The way it's being supplied is not important at this stage, but that is the one byproduct of these retail structured products, that the monetization of that product is selling volatility. So this is the primary reason why Korea surpassed Japan as the largest retail structured product player globally. However, we take a snapshot and just look at the current universe of outstanding retail structured products for the first time in history. According to the team at Bank of America, U.S. retail clients actually account for the largest single country share. So it is no longer an Asian phenomenon. And that makes total sense that we're seeing record volumes in the region. The S&P's rallied almost, what is it now, sixfold since crisis. There's growing acknowledgement that inflation-adjusted bond returns are almost guaranteed to lose money. It's unsurprising that we see this increased desire to diversify private wealth risk in North America. So private wealth in North America looks very different to Asia, but fundamentally, this is also bond substitution. So there's technical reasons for why the American pot has grown so much too. There's slight differences and nuances in the products. But if we leave that to one side right now, it's fascinating because everyone assumed they would never become popular in North America.
So you mentioned the term auto-callable, and I thought it would just be worthwhile for you to be a little more descriptive in terms of, from an end user standpoint, what are the characteristics of that product? And then two, you also alluded to the hedging and monetization. What does it leave the dealer who's providing this product in a position to have to do?
The auto callable, as I said, is like a bond-like product. It offers some potential coupon that is linked to the performance of an equity. So that can be a single equity, a single index, or a group of underlyings. The product is automatically called or effectively knocked out and ceases to exist if the reference underlying is at or above a predetermined level at a specified observation date in the future. So at maturity, provided that the underlying has not reached the knock-in barrier on the downside, at a minimum, the full capital will be returned. It's only if the barrier is activated is there any capital loss in the structure. Historically, when interest rates were higher, there was no need to put any capital at risk. That's why you had historically actually just a lot of structured products that were capital guaranteed. So auto calls can be essentially decomposed into these three components, which is the capital repayment portion, a market risk portion, and the reward portion. So in the capital repayment portion, like most structured products, uses a zero coupon bond to provide the capital repayment at maturity. On the market risk side, this is where it starts to get interesting. This is where there's much broader implications for vol markets around the world. So what you're effectively doing, you're selling crisis risk to maximize your coupon. Your assumption as a retail investor is that in the next 1 to 2 years, this given underlying, this given market, whether it be S&P or Nikkei, I do not believe is going to halve. So I will at least get my capital returned and hopefully I get some coupons too. That's the logic. In some respects, it's like the Buffett trades post-crisis, just monetizing very, very, very high volatility. So that's the basic premise from the retail side. From the investment banking side, what has actually happened and why it became so important to understand this market is because from a regulatory perspective, we witnessed the successive introduction of Dodd-Frank, EMIR, Basel III, and then finally the Volcker rules. So this is very, very important for a couple of reasons. But this dismantling of prop desks and this enforcing of substantial increases in capital buffers levied on banks saw aggregate value at risk drop 80% across the street. What does this mean? It means that banks no longer have the capacity or critically the discretion to warehouse all of these risks on their balance sheet. So unsurprisingly, there was huge implications for vol services. Prop desks provided very interesting things for market, but especially around liquidity provision, they were very, very helpful. You know, they played an incredibly important role in ensuring the integrity of markets, especially in times of turmoil. They were backed by banks' balance sheets, not beholden to monthly redemption schedules, unlike hedge funds. So prop desks had sizable risk tolerances, which allowed them to step into stress situations and take the other sides of trades. And so therefore, this abrupt removal of trading desk managing discretion meant that not only would there be limited liquidity provided in stress markets, but the facilitation of that sizable client activity became very problematic. So best efforts needed to be made to hedge this full risk, this full clip size at inception. And this is why it suddenly all became very, very important, because ultimately, because of the yield argument, you know, this thing we began with, retail structured product issuance started to explode exactly at the time when banks could no longer efficiently manage that risk, which is why vol surfaces and dividend term structures became so artificially distorted. You know, and in order to stay in this business and to stay relevant post-2014, banks needed to demonstrate to distributors their capacity to facilitate this continual issuance and reissuance cycles of these structured products, because sometimes they're often being called and then reissued in addition to placating regulators. So therefore, banks were forced to actively locate new hedging partners, and this multi-billion-dollar alternative risk transfer business, or ART, ART business as it's often referred to, was born. And so simplistically, on a mono product where we're just referencing one asset like an S&P, the way it works is that the Greeks risks, the derivative exposures in this are long delta, long correlation, short vega, short gamma, short dividends. Well, actually, correlations when you add on multiple underlines. But essentially, the bank has the other side of that trade. And as I just mentioned, they have to now nigh on formulaically hedge that. So banks are having to buy correlation back from the street. They have to buy delta at the beginning, and they have to sell vega, gamma, and dividends. And so that is fine at inception. You have time to do that, but it's then managing the second order Greeks that start causing a lot of problems. And so the barriers effectively create this dynamic whereby the vanna and vomma, so the second order derivatives, start deforming in very different ways to the vanillas. And this is what causes a lot of the issues. So one of the topics and one of the concepts you'll hear a lot people talk about is peak vega. It's one of the most critical concepts to grasp, but you don't have to understand the maths of it. That's actually not the most important thing. It's understanding what it practically means. If you aggregate all of the retail structure products across the entire street, the point at which the vega, so sensitivity to volatility, is greatest is called peak vega. So that's pretty simple. I think most people understand that. It will typically be somewhere 30% lower than the blended average of wherever the spot was at issuance. So one way to think about this inflection, if you like, where you have this peak vega, is the likelihood of the product being called, so being auto-called, as in the name of the product, and it no longer existing, versus that downside barrier, as we said, this crisis risk you're selling being activated. So the way it works is down 50% ordinarily. Once that kicks in, once we hit that on an observation date, that product becomes a very, very deep in the money put that the end retail client is short. And so at 51% of spot on the observation day, full capital to the retail investor. At 49, they've immediately taken 51% capital loss. And so once that downside barrier is activated, your Greek risk, especially on the exposure to volatility, is nigh on zero because you've just got something that's grossly in the money. It's like a Delta One product. And so because your vega goes to zero, that volatility falls off on the structured product much, much more rapidly than the vanilla that you've used to hedge it. So the typical hedge you would use as an investment bank is to sell approximately the 80% vanilla put, so back into your US listed market, if you were trading an S&P autocallable, that would effectively be your day one hedge, and the maturity you use would match the duration of the product. But since there are three things that could happen, we could be called, we could knock in, or we could just see it through to maturity, then we don't know what that duration really looks like. So we can't perfectly hedge anything in this construct. And so this is the way to think about it. In order to remain hedged, banks need to keep playing around with that vanilla hedge to ensure that they've got no outright exposure. When I traded these products, that wasn't such an important part of it, right? Because we didn't have Volcker rules. So I could run a very long vega or a very short vega, depending on what my views were of markets. That discretion is what's been taken. To be fair, it's actually more of a range than a peak. I would personally argue that plateau vega is a more accurate term. This is very conceptual. I think a time when this became super, super important was back in 2018. And again, this was in US markets. What happened was that you had an enormous move lower in a lot of single names. So your mega tech, which was referencing a lot of these retail structured products, because over time, we had to go up the risk scale and take on more idiosyncratic risk when we're selling retail structured products to get a larger coupon for the end retail investor, because as everyone's very well aware, index falls were very, very low. So what actually happened is over that period at the end of 2018, when the average mega cap tech stock was down 40% on average, your Netflix, your Facebooks, that peak to trough drawdown was very substantial. The S&P only moved 20%. Obviously, it's very large, but you have some assets that are referencing S&P down 20%, and a lot of retail structured products referencing Netflix, Facebook, suffering a 40% drawdown. As I said earlier in the discussion, typically peak vega is about 30% down on spot. And so you had the index on one side of this argument and the stocks on the other side. And this was a really bizarre situation, because what was going on here was you were finally seeing the overwhelming power of retail structured products. And we'll get into why that was the case and why they were the incremental driver. But we've never witnessed a 20% drop in the S&P before with no reciprocal follow through on convexity. S&P skew was relatively flat as everything else in the single stocks was blowing up. And this is because of this peak vega dynamic. Affected crudely, the peak vega, if you think about it, is the inflection point at which banks switch from being forced sellers of volatility to forced buyers of volatility. So going into that peak vega, so going down 10%, 20%, 30% as an investment bank, I'm still selling more volatility to ensure my retail structured product book is hedged. Once we breach that, so once I'm 31, 32, 33% lower on spots, I suddenly have to buy an awful lot of volatility. And that's what we experienced over this period. And that's why this notion of peak vega is so important, because you have this formulaic hedging going on by banks in very, very large size. I mean, it's an overused word these days, but this was truly unprecedented, which is why I even wrote a paper about this back in January 2019 called Deconstructing American Smiles, which I assume is still somewhere in the dark corners of the SocGen research website. But that explains fully this non-intuitive movement and how it entirely rationalized the market structure of volatility through our understanding of retail clients. Retail had suddenly become the incremental driver of US vol surfaces, and we'd never seen that before.
There's a lot of really interesting stuff there. And as you mentioned, 2018, we had a couple of things in 2018. After a 6.8 realized on the S&P in 2017, we had a lot of action, both at the beginning with the Volmageddon and at the end of 2018 as well. And this is where I wanted to go and just try to drive home some of these points a little bit further, get more of your insights here. When we look at vol surfaces and we think about volatility, we generally make the assumption that lower markets, higher vol, it's just more instability, more uncertainty in the world. But at least in the US, sometimes there's, I think, an oversimplification of the global environment for the supply of and demand for volatility. That's what's effectively going to govern the price. And it's just assumed, well, the banks have got to be short volatility. And as markets go down, they're going to be delta hedging in a way that accelerates volatility. The picture you're painting is far more complex. And one of the things you talked about as we were chatting before we jumped on was just this giant relative value trade between, for example, Nikkei and S&P. Long Nikkei, short S&P, long anything. Short S&P was a trade that felt like it paid off, whether it was dispersion or Euro stocks, all kinds of trade constructions relative to the S&P. I wanted to see if you could give us some more insights in terms of what you saw in terms of implementation of that trade, what worked, and then effectively, because this thing really unraveled last March of 2020, how did you look at maybe the buildup of vulnerabilities in this very lopsided trade construction?
Take a step back and think about the discussion around skew. So unlike in a commodity market, or crypto vol even these days, negative skew, so this notion that downside volatility should be priced higher than at the money volatility and upside volatility, this is a typical feature in equity markets that we've seen over the years, and very, very clean. And there's a host of reasons why this should be the case. You know, you alluded to some of them, just natural hedging, et cetera. People being more fearful of the downside, but at a fundamental level as well, you know, if a stock is meaningfully lower, ceteris paribus, you've created an instantaneous rise in the debt to equity ratio, assuming the debt burden hasn't changed. So that stock is theoretically a riskier entity. So this forced hedging of all of these Asian indices, which is depressing this 80% put all of the time, or approximately the 80% put, this distorts these fundamental premises that we've kind of grew up with. Meanwhile, in the US, you've got this opposite structural trend prevailing where there's a permanent bid to vol and skew as large insurers and natural buyers of downside volatility. as a function of their hedging needs coming from that huge variable annuity book. So in addition to the substantial institutional overriding community, you have this buy revolve too. So it provides a permanent bid to skew. So you've got these powerful structural drivers in the US doing one thing, and you've got these opposing structural forces in Asia doing something else. And so at the height of this skew imbalance, the 80%, 120% skew differential in the US was trading almost 11 points richer than the average large cap Asian index. You know, think about that for a second. This would be huge on indices that were anywhere near similar in volatility. But the S&P vol has generally traded, sort of at the money vol, has generally traded 4 or 5 points lower than Asian indices for the past 20 years, if not more. Therefore, from a parameter perspective, this relative value trade being long Asian variance, Asian volatility versus selling S&P, wonderfully captured the extremity of this structural distortion. You were short the artificially overpriced tail in the US, or at least theoretically overpriced tail, and then you were long the theoretically underpriced Asian leg. So a variance swap is a good way to capture the breadth of this dislocation, because then obviously, you know, it's referencing volatility across the strip. So the price ended up being very, very compelling. You know, in some cases, you were long Asian vol, short US vol, and getting paid for the pleasure. I mean, it was a beautiful trade. Very few, if any, vol or macro funds, mandate permitting, who didn't at some point have risk allocated to this, whether they want to admit it or not. You know, at its peak in all formats, including vanilla variances and corridor variances, and we'll get onto what a corridor is in a second, but the estimates that I hear for the total trade size range from about $1 to $1.5 billion gross vega notionals. So we're talking about $500 to $750 million in the Asian leg alone. So to be clear, the largest ever outstanding order callable vega risk ever accumulated in Asia was about $400 million. So at the height of its popularity, the recycled risk in this trade was considerably in excess of the underlying risk it was supposedly hedging. I think it was one of my former employers. It was Credit Suisse who pioneered this corridor. That's when this market really took off, you know, and the logic was genius, but there just became this unhealthy obsession with the trade. And between 2015 to 2018, money managers the world over, they were suffering such debilitating and withdrawal effects from this non-medical affliction I like to call volatility deficiency disorder, or VDD, sounds even naughtier. They were willing to go to great lengths to pick up any extra dose of premium they could find to soothe their pain, which is why we saw such oversized risk-taking in these pairs. You know, at one point, I think I even saw corridors trade on Asian FX markets. I mean, such was the level of comfort reached in this product for macro accounts. And, you know, this was probably the first signs that this trade was just being over-engineered.
Let me jump in and just, you know, as we think about the wreckage of 2020, obviously when a vol event hits, there's a correlation in volatilities, but the outperformance, so to speak, of US vol, I think for a month, the S&P outrealized the Nikkei by, I would say, almost 45 or so vols, obviously wreaked havoc on these long short trades. Is the positioning itself a big part of that? Obviously, the U.S. is the largest economy. It shut down, so you're going to see a substantial market disruption. But to what degree is the positioning going into this, as you describing it, very, very significant sponsorship of this one type of trade that effectively left people short S&P vol against some other pair? How much of it, Andrew, do you think was positioning going in?
So look, it was clearly a very, very large trade. By 2020, it wasn't such a large trade. I couldn't give you exact numbers on it, but that's why I actually don't believe it was the positioning that created this massive differential in performance of vol. It was clearly exacerbated the dynamic that was going on, but I think there were a few other things going on in the background. You know, let me just go through a couple of those things. I remember presenting alongside Chris Cole at a forum in New York, not long after I moved out there. And he put together this thesis on outrageous size of the implicit short vol trade, artificially stabilizing markets in the US. And my first thought was, man, thanks, Chris. You know, my presentation looks garbage now. But, you know, once I put my ego aside, my second thought was really focused on this processing the frightening dynamic and bizarre notion that the S&P had become the biggest buyer of the S&P. U.S. corporates had bought some $5 trillion of their own shares in the decade post-crisis. Then you have this colossal shift toward indexing, which our mutual friend Mike Green has obviously done an incredible amount of analysis on, regarding, how should we call this, the passive aggressiveness of passive investors. Powerful market forces, backstopped by the Fed, had combined to ensure between 9th of December 2011, the 26th of February 2020, we saw 9 daily closes of the VIX recorded above 30. Then the pandemic hit, and by the 10th of March, what had taken almost 9 years to achieve was just experienced in 9 straight days. And so you put it perfectly. You gave an interview on Bloomberg Surveillance last week, I think it was. You know, effectively, the pandemic destroyed all of the risk-bearing capital that was short vol in the US. Man, they love you on Bloomberg, Dean. It was a veritable love fest.
And pay them well.
But honestly, it's entirely understandable why so many people were seduced into the short S&P vol, whether they were buying Asian vol against it or not, because S&P acts very bimodal vis-a-vis Asian vol. For much of the time, US vol realizes very, very poorly for a lot of these structural dynamics, and you have momentum strategies too, which exacerbate that, until it rather emphatically does not. So there was a confluence of drivers that were moving against this trade, such as the unwind of this implicit short. And the most powerful one for me was actually what was going on in the insurance business. So you remember at the beginning, I explained why we had this legacy skew bid in North America, largely down to the insurance industry. But what was actually going on was, in the background, very slowly, you had a massive product redesign of variable annuities. More and more vol risk was being passed on to policyholders at source. It was as early as 2014, AIG even explicitly linked the fee structure of their products to the VIX. So while the overall VA business, the headline numbers had told us that this business had doubled in size between 2008 and 2018, so over $2 trillion, what it wasn't telling us was that 70% of that new business was in vol-managed funds, meaning that there was much reduced demand from insurers to actually buy vol. So this had been historically the biggest offset of any retail flow that was coming to America. Not that there was a lot historically, but while that grew through 17, 18, 19, as it was the center of speculation in the world, especially from Asian retail, this insurer that we assumed was always there to buy volatility was no longer there and anywhere near the size. So we've only ever seen demand for long-dated US index fall until the last couple of years, and that completely flipped. So retail investors had influenced the term structures and smile of Asian market forever, but we'd never seen them drive US vol surfaces the way they do. And putting together all of these structural forces, the unwind of that implicit short, the removal of a buyer, and the new depression of volatility through Asian retail, and as I started the show telling you about American retail also having a part in that, this assumption that Asian vol would always trade at a higher beta to the US in a global sell-off was emphatically discredited. And so it wasn't so much the risk that was in this pairs trade that exacerbated this positioning. It was actually all the structural dynamics that were going on that just cleaned out the US side. And there was just an enormous bid to vol from that.
You mentioned both Mike Green and Chris Cole, two really, really good thinkers.
I also get paid for mentioning their names.
Right, exactly. One of Chris's quotes over time, I think he's just a great thinker on these things. He's got a couple that I've really enjoyed. I'll give you three. One, he said that the stock market is a derivative of the derivatives market. I really like that. He said that volatility is an instrument of truth. I really like that one too. And the last one I wanted to get your take on, because I think some of what you're describing here fits in this category. He said that vol is not just a statistic we look at and calculate. It's now a player on the field. It sort of strikes me in the context of whether it's the convexity element and the hedging implications of that, or perhaps you were talking about some of the vol control trades and structures that are out there as well. How does that quote hit you? What does it mean to you?
I personally love to make fun of Chris Cole, but the guy is a genius. His visual imagery around volatility markets is wonderful. He is absolutely correct. And that's a nice, simple way to think about it. A volatility was this very opaque thing sitting in the backdrops that rarely disturbed anyone that was trading markets inside 3 to 6 months. A lot of things dramatically changed post-crisis, which brought it front and center. So you know, quite right, you have this huge universe of vol control, whether it's in direct vol control indices of vol managed mutual funds, or it's through insurer products, but you've got such a preponderance of that in markets that volatility has become an enormous player in spot markets. And from a retail structured product perspective, durations have only fallen over the years. These were generally five-year products with an average duration of, let's say, 2-3 years. That has come down the term structure very, very rapidly. So part of that conversation is because you don't have much of an offset out there anymore. So the US in particular, we didn't have that insurer to offset that risk anymore. So we had to come down and try to find more listed vanilla risk. So we had to come down in maturities. That's one drive. The second drive is the product redesigns that have been going on. I mean, I don't know if you're aware of what these things are, but things like lizard notes or glider notes have all reduced the duration of these products quite dramatically. They've added so many features that increase the likelihood of a product knocking out that there's just this constant recycling of that risk that's come into the 6-month, 1-year bucket. You know, think about it. Go back to the hedge. My hedge of a retail structured product historically was selling an 18-month or 2-year 80% put. The probability of this product being called is very, very high now on the first observation, and I no longer have that risk on my trading book. I might just sell an at-the-money 3-month put or an at-the-money 3-month call. So suddenly, you're hitting different parts of the vol curve. You've got different delta gamma profiles. And probably the market where we've seen this most disruptive was 2015 in Chinese markets. So if we look at a market like HSCEI, so much of that retail structured product that was referencing, and this gives us a bit of a glimpse of our potential future, so much of that retail structured product issuance was referencing this one index to the extent that the Korean regulators were exceptionally nervous that the morning open and afternoon close, the delta that was being adjusted on those two times of the day was aggressively shifting reality, shifting fundamentals. And so that was already, we saw 6 years ago in Chinese market, the power of vol and the things you have to hedge to trade these products impacting spot markets. So he's got some great quotes, and I love the instrument of truth one, but this one I think is very powerful and something that I've spent my career trying to educate people about, because I don't want this barrier to entry and knowledge of this ever being education. None of these things are that complicated. Someone just needs to be willing to spend the time to explain the practical implications of this. We could talk about the maths all day long, but it's not going to help people redesign their own trading books.
Well, I've got a couple of more areas to focus on, and then I'd love to close and just hear from you in terms of the focus at Bach Option with Dr. Wu. Exciting new venture for you guys. Let's talk a little bit about the vol risk premium, this concept of vol markets or insurance markets, and the insurance providers need to be compensated along the way. There was a lot of debate right around March or April of 2020 between Nassim Taleb and Cliff Asness. So two pretty big names in markets and specifically on the vol side. And the question is really around insurance and is it worth it? We know the characteristics of the short vol trade. It works most of the time, but there's a substantial, sometimes almost unsurvivable negative skew to the outcomes. Big picture, how do you think about vol risk premium, or how should investors think about vol risk premium, especially, Andrew, in light of what seems like zero-ish interest rates for even a long time going forward from here? How do you survive in markets these days and not be short vol?
You just buy Bitcoin, right?
Right.
Nick, I think if I give you the lens that I'm speaking from now, we are a net long vol fund. But in terms of monetizing risk premiums, if that's all you do, then clearly you're going to do very, very well for several years until you don't. And there's a wipeout stage. But it doesn't mean you shouldn't do it. You may well still make more money over that period, but you just cannot look at this strategy from a yearly returns perspective, whatever the strategy may be. There are so many different strategies you could deploy in the short vol world, but you're absolutely right to try to monetize risk premium when you think it's expensive. It's just how you go about that can be exceptionally dangerous. There are safer ways to do it. For instance, you know, one of the strategies we deploy is being long convexity, being long the wings, and selling at the money struck volatility. So we're effectively monetizing perhaps a vol premium around the moneyness, but overall we know we don't have a lot of downside overall. There's only so much money we can lose. So that's a predetermined loss, if you like, versus just wildly selling variance because you think it's overpriced. It just depends how you go about it. And again, it's not whether one's right or the other, it's what you as an allocator want. So if you're just allocating a small amount to something that is potentially quite dangerous, but is going to give you decorrelated returns, and is a small allocation for you, you might not mind if in year six that goes to zero. You probably will mind at the time, but if you're thinking about it over longer term time horizons, you could still net have made money from that allocation. So again, this is not to say long vol is better than short vol. It's just very different. There were some of the best vol managers I've met in my life. If you go back to some of the emerging managers in London, that macro crew, some of them spent an entire career selling volatility on the most dangerous and illiquid emerging market indices there were and made enormous amounts of money. So it's timing. It's what the strategy is. Is it systematic? And what's the logic? So all I would say is if you're going to allocate to a short vol strategy, just understand what you're getting out of it.
So one of the things we saw, of course, last year during the height of the vol event was an extreme correlation event as well. People calculate this in different ways, but realized correlation on the S&P was darn near 100, implied was darn near 100. So from a trading strategy, a correlation and dispersion trading strategy, that would seem to have been pretty challenging. You've got a lot of insights on that form of the derivatives trade as well. Tell us about what you see in the world of dispersion trading these days.
I mean, from my perspective, dispersion has been one of the ART strategies that has existed the whole way through and will persistently exist. And there's a few reasons for that. First of all, the traditional products were referencing a one underlying an S&P and Nikkei. But as vols collapsed, as I said, you got a much higher allocation going into single name risk, which banks needed to hedge. And so if you think about the way you hedge, there's so many parameters that we didn't get into today, but you directly hedge a Greek risk, and usually in the form of a swap. So you could do a correlation swap, a div swap to hedge those pieces. And you have the alternative version, which is a proxy hedge. And so you make practical best efforts. So one of the things that banks have done exceptionally well in the last few years is try to buy back correlation in all those single names via selling dispersion packages, custom dispersion packages, because there's not many other way. You know, you can't buy a correlation swap on Apple versus Tesla. I mean, someone might make you a price, but it's not a liquid market. You can trade correlation swaps on equities versus bonds, on Euro stocks versus Nikkei, S&P versus Kospi. Those exist, but in single stocks, that doesn't exist. So dispersion became this huge, huge business. And I think there's something we at Bark Option are very active into, and it's an area we spend a lot of time on. And I have high hopes for that business going forward, because not only now do you have this constant leadership changes at a sectoral and factor level taking place, but you have this idiosyncratic noise as a function of the Reddit and Wall Street crowd too. So that makes dispersion very, very interesting. So you're right, the performance at 100 correlation is obviously terrible on a dispersion strategy, because what you need to happen is half the stocks to go up, half of them to go down, and the index to do nothing. That's your perfect P&L on a dispersion strategy. So over that period, it performed poorly, but I don't think anyone was allocated it disproportionately that it, you know, kicked them out of the businesses like some of the other ART products, which hurts a lot of people. But to my mind, you know, we can make a broader generalization about retail. The younger generation of retail are going to continue to lift the front end of vol markets through their use of tactical leverage. The older generation will continually depress the back end of vol in their hunt for yield. So this is why I believe retail investors deserve to be called the largest player in the room, which just happens to be the title of our upcoming paper, which we're about to publish, and all of the topics we've discussed today and some insights on the future. A shameless plug, but if you'll allow me, if you follow Bark Option on LinkedIn, you'll receive a copy of that in the next couple of weeks.
As you guys at Bark Option think about the set of circumstances that might effectively catalyze volatility, create some resurgence in it, maybe not 80, but something north of where we're stuck at now. How do you guys think about that? You know, we've talked a lot about product overlay. We've talked about some of the macro forces. What are the things that are top of mind for you and your team at Bock Option in terms of where vol markets go and what could be the catalyst for where they go?
The obvious one, it's sad to say, but if we fail to immunize a sufficiently high enough percentage of the world's population before a more deadly strain of COVID evolves, that would be potentially another March 2020 event, sadly. So that's one risk. I hope it never plays out. But more likely, I suppose, would be a policy misstep. And we're getting closer and closer to that moment, potentially. And one of the factors that we've been paying a lot of attention to is inflation. Rampant inflation, we think, is essentially the existential threat to asset allocation in its current form. We likened it to, in a paper we wrote, a Plinian eruption of a volcano. That is the most violent volcano there is. It's basically named after Pliny the Younger, whose letters were the sole surviving documented account of the eruption at Mount Vesuvius, which entirely wiped out several ancient Roman cities. And we think rampant inflation has the power to do the same to unprepared portfolios. This is what the Fed believes is the correct thing to happen in this environment. Allow some transitory inflation. But if it actually gets out of control, it is the one thing that the toolkit cannot solve for. They will have to raise rates. And if they don't, that will cause other problems. So I think, you know, we're getting closer to the risks of a policy misstep. I think that is problematic. At the same time, you know, I'm reading the other day, the short vol position is starting to grow quite large again. So you've got some an exacerbator in the system there as well. But from, you know, personal experience, if you take COVID as a one-off, geopolitical risks are the one other area that you can never really historically predict very accurately, but we're never very far away from. And that's something that I spend a lot of time now and historically nervous about too. But actually, a structural entrant back in the market could be insurers. So bizarrely, there's going to be a FASB accounting rule update. It was supposed to go through this year. I think it's got delayed potentially 1 year or 2 years again. If that was brought closer, then they'd have to hedge the guaranteed minimum benefits on long duration contracts, and they would then bring back an active public insurer in the vol. So that would be the structural driver of a purchaser, a demand for vol, which we haven't seen for a very long time. But I think barring that, it's inflation one, geopolitics two.
I think those are great points. Markets are experts in discounting uncertainty, but I would say both of those sets of risks, inflation because it's been so long since it's been an issue for markets, and then geopolitics because none of that fits into a spreadsheet, would be especially vexing for markets. Well, Andrew, we've covered a lot of ground here today. Your insights on a lot of the complexity that is the derivatives market and the impact on risk-taking and hedging and where vol ultimately clears, I think are substantial. And I really appreciate you taking the time here to be a guest on the Alpha Exchange. Thanks so much.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Dean. Thanks for having me on the show. You know, my friends are always telling me I have a face for radio, so I assume that logic extends to podcasts. So thanks for letting me tick that box. But on a more serious note, if you'll permit me just one more minute, I just want to make one final personal comment. I think the work you're doing with Macro Minds and the various charities you support focused on reducing that educational shortfall is just incredible, Dean. You know, and I'd urge all of the listeners to support your efforts in any way. Education is so critically important in life. My parents were both extremely hardworking and intelligent, but barely finished high school, never mind attended college. And in fact, I was not only the first person to get accepted by the London School of Economics from the high school I attended, I was the first person to even apply, which is just very sad. So I'm forever thankful for the opportunities I was given that I know others around me were unfortunately not. But anyway, this has been a lot of fun. Very good man, Dean, and thank you kindly once again for having me on.
It was a real pleasure, and we will catch up soon. And best of luck with Dr. Wu. I think you guys will do some great stuff at Bock Option.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to the Alpha Exchange. Before we go, I wanted to share with you an inspirational investment symposium I'm hosting on May 11th and 12th on behalf of Macro Minds, the foundation I launched in 2018 in order to raise money for nonprofits that focus on helping improve educational opportunities for children in the New York area. Our initiative is based on two primary ideas. First, educational shortfall for families is self-reinforcing. One statistic, the children of college-educated parents are 7 times as likely to go to college as are those whose parents did not finish high school. Working together, we can help push back against this cycle. The second idea behind MacroMinds is that the community of finance professionals is at its best when we engage together on the many difficult questions out there. Disinflation, crowded trades, monetary policy, cryptocurrencies, and the cost of hedging are just a few of these. Set against these uncertainties, what are the considerations most relevant to portfolio construction? What's the next big thing in finance and markets? On May 11th and 12th, these important topics will be explored. I couldn't be more excited to bring to you such accomplished market professionals who are offering their time and providing their insights. I hope that you will consider both attending and sponsoring the event. More on MacroMinds and the symposium can be found on our webpage, macrominds.org. On behalf of our partner charities, I sincerely thank you for your support.